Good afternoon, everyone. I call this meeting of the Senate Education Committee to order. It is 3:32 p.m. here on Monday, April 13th. We are meeting in the Belts Committee Room here in the State Capitol Building located in beautiful downtown Juneau, which is back to its glorious, gloomy, raining weather. I just want to remind folks who are here in the room if they could please mute their cell phones. Documents for today's meetings have been distributed to members. They are also available for folks on BASIS, that is akleg.gov, and there's additional copies right there by the door. Members present today are Senator Keel, Senator Yunt, Senator Bjorkman, and myself, Senator Lukey Gale Tobin. Please let the record reflect we do have a quorum to conduct business. I want to thank Jude from the Juneau LIO for moderating today's meeting, and Mary Gwen, as always, from Senate Records for being with us to document today's meeting. On the agenda today, we will have the first hearing for House Joint Resolution 39, urging the federal government to waive the new H-1B visa fees for teachers in the state. We will be taking public testimony. If you would like to provide public testimony on House Joint Resolution 39, please call one of the following telephone numbers. From Anchorage, 907-563-9085. From Juneau, 907-586-9085. And all other locales, please call this toll-free number, 1-844-586-9085. You can also testify from your local legislative information office or email your public testimony to senate.education@akleg.gov. That's senate.education@akleg.gov. Please let the record reflect we were joined by President Stevens at 3:33 p.m. Today, we will also receive a presentation from the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development about Alaska's regional education attendance areas. We will have our first hearing of Senate Concurrent Resolution 17, recognizing the 50th anniversary of the creation of the regional education attendance areas. And at that time, we'll also be taking invited testimony. I'm also adding Senate Bill 277 to the agenda under bills previously heard. We do have a committee substitute for the bill. All right, moving on to our first item on the agenda, House Joint Resolution 39. House Joint Resolution 39 is sponsored by Representative Elise Galvin. I believe we are joined by her Ted Stevens legislative intern, Dan Hires, to introduce the bill. Mr. Hires, if you could please identify yourself for the record and begin your remarks.
For the record, Dan Hires, legislative intern to Representative Galvin. Thank you to Senate Education Committee for hearing this resolution. I'd like to begin by just talking about what the purpose of the resolution is. It's to mitigate further disruptions to education in Alaska, because right now, the executive order that is imposing a new $100,000 federal fee on the H-1B visa application process is making it so schools cannot afford to hire the educators that they are relying on. According to the Alaska Council of School Administrators, there are close to 600 international teachers working in Alaska, and 341 of them use H-1B visas, which means that the hiring of over 300 international educators is jeopardized. Without these educators, class sizes increase, course offerings shrink, student services are reduced, and student outcomes suffer. Alaska faces persistent difficulties in recruiting and retaining teachers, especially in rural and remote communities. As the state works to grow our own educators and recruit teachers from out of state, H-1B educators work to help bridge gaps in critical teacher shortages that would not be filled otherwise. School districts across Alaska use international recruitment to fill these school vacancies, with cases of international hires filling up to 60% of teaching staff in Western Alaska, Kodiak, and North Slope districts. Alaska schools have come to rely on the H-1B visa program, but the administration's recent proclamation greatly reduces their ability to hire staff by imposing a steep financial burden on all employers for H-1B applications occurring after September 22, 2025. Previously, school districts invested around $6,000 to $12,000 per teacher to recruit and sponsor educators through the H-1B visa process. Adding this $100,000 federal visa fee has made it impossible for the districts to continue hiring the teachers that the students rely on. The H-1B H-1B visa program has facilitated the employment of skilled professionals in hard-to-fill subject areas in Alaska, such as science, mathematics, and special education for decades. However, they're not replacements for in-state educators. International educators pose no threat to hiring in-state educators. The Alaska Educator Retention and Recruitment Center actively works to grow in-state capacity by assisting with mentorship and induction programs alongside international recruiting efforts. According to a 2022 study by the Economic Policy Institute, the average teacher in Alaska earns 26.4 less than other professionals with college degrees. This gap could be offset by providing an excellent benefits package and a robust defined benefit retirement system, but those aren't available right now. The H-1B visas have been a solution to this outmigration. This process allows qualified international candidates to respond to the needs of understaffed schools and fill unoccupied positions. These visas are a strategic necessity for filling critical vacancies in districts that have no other applicants. Without receiving waivers for this fee, education in Alaska will be further disrupted. More classes will be cut, and class sizes will inflate. So I'd like to conclude by just urging you to support the resolution. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Hires. Are there any questions? Seeing none, I want to thank you again. We will now move on to your invited testifier. We are joined by the Director of Education Recruitment and, Alaska Educator Retention and Recruitment, Director Jennifer Schmitz. Ms. Schmitz, I believe you have a short presentation for us.
Yes, I do. Can you hear me okay?
We can.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Chair Tobin and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jennifer Schmitz, and I'm the director of the Alaska Educator Retention and Recruitment Center, which is a division of the Alaska Council of School Administrators. In Alaska, teacher vacancies aren't just a staffing issue. They are students waiting for stability, and our work focuses on helping districts fill positions, especially in areas where local pipelines simply can't meet the demand. One of the most important tools districts rely on today is international recruitment, which is why I'm here today to ask you to support House Joint Resolution 39. Next slide. Alaska continues to face significant educator shortages across the state. This is especially difficult in rural and remote communities where recruitment challenges are compounded by housing shortages, high costs, and geographic isolation. Without additional hiring tools, many classrooms simply would not have teachers. Slide three, next slide please, sorry. This shows the same information that you just saw, but broken down by location. Even when districts work aggressively to recruit, the number of available Alaska certified applicants is limited. We just hosted our first ever virtual job fair for students at Alaska universities, which really is exciting. But even if we place all of them, we will still have many, many openings. It's really important that we are filling positions that would otherwise remain vacant. And international hiring has become a necessary workforce strategy. And if you can see there on that slide at the bottom two rural remote areas, I truly believe that the teacher shortages would be as high as the principal shortages if we weren't using international teachers in those areas. They're really making a difference for retention in our remote and rural schools. Next slide. To address these shortages, Alaska districts have turned to international recruitment. This slide helps illustrate it's not just an Alaska issue. Across the U.S., states and school districts are increasingly hiring internationally because the domestic teacher pipelines are not keeping up with the demand. Next slide. Districts, as you heard from the previous presenter, districts start the year with hundreds of vacancies, and many are filled with emergency certificates with people who aren't necessarily certified in those areas. These unfilled positions lead to larger class sizes or teachers working outside of their endorsement areas. These numbers show just how important our visa teachers have become in Alaska. Over the past several years, hundreds of teachers have come to Alaska using H-1B visas. In 2025 alone, 183 H-1B teachers arrived to take jobs in our classrooms. More districts are relying on this pathway each year, and many schools would not be staffed as well as they are without it. Next slide. In This just talks about the number of visa teachers that we have currently, and you can see that there were currently, at the beginning of the year, 341 on H-1B visas and 232 on J-1 visas. Next slide, please. These are a few of the facts around H-1Bs in Alaska today. Looking ahead to the 26-27 school year, districts are deeply concerned. The current federal cost structure makes H-1B hiring extremely difficult, if not impossible, for our districts. Without relief, they might not be able to hire the teachers that they need. This is why we need action now. The hiring timelines are long, and districts are already planning for the fall. And if we want international teachers to arrive in time for the start of school, we have to hire right away, right now. Next slide. I mentioned J-1 teachers. We have quite a few on J-1s across the state, and they used to be a really great viable option for Alaska. However, recent federal interpretations have restricted placement in rural and remote communities. Because many Alaska communities don't meet those requirements, J-1 visas are no longer a viable solution for much of our state. In fact, we are in the process of transitioning those who can to H-1Bs or having to replace them. That makes this hiring or this access to H-1Bs even more critical. Next slide. I would like to show a slide of our teachers. These are some teachers who on the outside arrived this year. One on the left, Catherine, is in the Kenai Peninsula Borough School District. And on the right, April went out to Iditarod. And the middle picture is a teacher named Joby, and Joby is in Yukon Koyukuk School District, and she has to go home this year after her J-1 years have run out. And the students in the picture went to the superintendent there and asked if they could get passports to go with her because they just connected with her and she's become a really important part of the community. And on another note, actually, after I even put this presentation together, I got a call from that district asking if they could begin the process of sponsoring a green card for her while she's home doing her 2 years, so she could come back on an H-1B and a green card and become a permanent part of their staff, which is really exciting. And last slide, please. Thank you for your time and your focus on Alaska's educator workforce and supporting the children in Alaska. International hiring is not the only solution, but it's an essential one right now. And I urge you to support House Student Resolution 39. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Director Schmitz. Is there any questions from committee members? Seeing none, I want to thank you again for your presentation. Before we move on to public testimony, are there any additional questions from committee members? Seeing none, I'll now open public testimony for HJR 39. Is there anyone here in the room who wishes to testify? Seeing no one and seeing no one online, I will now close public testimony for HJR 39. I'm going to hold HJR 39 until a future meeting. If you have any interest in changing language or components to the resolution, if you could please work with the sponsor's office and my office, and we will get those drafted and bring that forth at a later date. Thank you, Mr. Hires. We will now move on to the next item on our agenda, which is a presentation from the Department of Education and Early Development about Alaska's regional education attendance area. Joining us for today's presence is Lori Weed, the school finance manager from the Department of Education and Early Development, who is here in person. We are also joined by Heather Heineken, who is online and who is the director of finance and support services. Hello, Ms. Weed. You know the drill. If you could please identify yourself for the record and begin your presentation when you are ready.
All right. Good afternoon, Chair Tobin, members of the Senate Education Committee. So delightful to be here today again. My name is Lori Weed, and as mentioned, I am the school finance manager with the Department of Education and Early Development. As mentioned, Heather is online, should we have any questions for her as well. We've been invited to talk to the committee a little bit about regional educational attendance areas, also known as REAAs. You will hear that a lot because it's a lot easier to say. Okay. I know you've seen these next two slides a lot, so I'll just say thank you for the opportunity again to provide the information and resources to the committee. And we look forward to the committee's work on subjects that will impact and support Alaska's educational challenge strategic priorities. And because we use acronyms a lot, we do like to start a presentation with some of the ones you'll probably see or hear today. some of these, like the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development, or DCCED, do take up a lot of space, as does the Regional Educational Attendance Area and Small Municipal School District School Fund, also known as the REAA Fund. So that is how we refer to that one throughout the slide. So today we will touch on a variety of your requested topics, including the history of providing educational services in Alaska, the establishment of the REAAs on REAA school boards, funding of the educational services, facility ownership in REAAs, and capital funding of facilities. So a little territorial history, because to understand where we are, I think it's always really important to ground ourselves in where what came before and where we came from, and to understand how we are where we are today. Super grateful for the testifier who will be here for the joint resolution, because they have the firsthand knowledge. When Alaska was a territory, cities were, at least according to the laws of the time, as identified in the Alaska Compiled Laws Annotated, wholly responsible for raising and providing funds to maintain public schools. However, the Territory of Alaska could choose to refund a percentage of those costs, and likely did. I don't have direct information. For areas outside of cities, those in the unorganized area, education was provided by the U.S. Federal government via the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the BIA. So once we became a state, Alaska and the BIA coordinated planning for Alaska to take over the system, but we needed some additional federal support to get there, and it took a fair amount of time for the processes to happen to transfer more than 150 schools, properties, and related facilities to the state and municipalities and to Native corporations. This included land and property transfers, which requires surveys, public process, potential negotiation of terms. The federal law required that the BIA not fund any schools after June 30, 1985, although some sites did not get the title transferred for another couple of years. They were not providing operational funds. Ultimately, there were 87 school sites transferred to the state of Alaska, some to the Department of Natural Resources, some to, quote, school authorities, and some then specifically to the Department of Ed. So it's been a little bit of a mixed bag about where title resides within the entity of the state of Alaska. It's caused some difficulties along the way. Statutorily, the framers of the Alaska Constitution did set responsibility for public education with the legislature, and additionally, the Constitution provides that the legislature sits as the assembly for the unorganized borough where the REAAs reside. The legislature then, through statute, later divided that area outside of the organized cities and boroughs, those home rule or first-class municipalities, into regional educational attendance areas. And the legislature delegated certain powers and duties to those school districts, typically through elected school boards, regarding the maintaining of educational facilities and educational programs. Those duties specific to REAAs are in Alaska Statute 1408, which provides education in the unorganized borough, and were first enacted in 1975. And those for the municipalities are in Alaska Statute 1414, which provides for local administration of schools and was first established earlier in the 1966. Overall, the large majority of duties are the same or similar between the two types of entities, with municipal school districts having additional requirements with regarding to interactions with its city or borough. The Department of Education exercises general supervision over public schools. DEED does not typically differentiate the supervision between municipal or REAA schools. Each school district is held to the same standards and bodies of law. In the prior slide, I did generalize a little bit when I said that the legislature established REAAs in the unorganized borough. Specifically, the statute, AS 1408-031, instructed the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development, the Department of Education and Early Development, and local communities to divide the unorganized borough into educational service areas that met certain criteria. This included utilizing the boundaries of the Alaska Native Claim Settlement Act regional corporations and consider areas that had homogeneous linguistics and cultural areas, as well as take into consideration transportation and communication between communities. Some boundaries also were to consider potential revenue should those areas become incorporated boroughs. For those that recall the boundary change between Yukon Flats and Yukon Koyukuk School District for the Rampart community, I believe that zigzag had been incorporated for those economic reasons. Other than this more recent example, the boundaries have been in place since they were originally set, with an exception of a local vote for forming what are called federal transfer regional educational attendance areas that occurred in 1985 for the villages of Akiachak, Akiak, Tuluksuk, Chifornik, those four within the boundaries of the lower Kuskokwim REAA School District, and Chivak within the lower Yukon School District. This led to the formation of the Kashinimut School District with the community of Chivak, and then the formation of the Yupit School District by Akiachak, Akiak, and Tuluksuk. The vote in Chifornik, it kept it part of the lower Kuskokwim School District. So you'll recall that the REAA boundaries were similar to the boundaries of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, regional corporations, with additional considerations for those cultural similarities. So I wanted to give a visual about how those corporation boundaries align with the boundaries at the district. So you can see a fairly close alignment in the slide overlay. There are currently 52 school districts and the state-operated boarding school, Mount Edgecombe High School. On the incorporated side, there are 19 boroughs, 14 cities with the powers of providing education, and in the unorganized borough, there are 19 REAAs that have been created. So and those REAA districts are spread out across Alaska. As you will see, they do incorporate a large majority of our areas. So a school board's primary duty is to provide an educational program for each school-age child who is enrolled or is in a resident of the district. To assist with this, they are empowered to hire a superintendent or chief school administrator to oversee the day-to-day management, and they may establish advisory boards in each community to advise on matters and needs specific to that community. The school board sets out policies for the district, whether those are educational policies supporting required standards and local initiatives, those for personnel and procurement, and those relating to facilities care, management, and usage. In support of those policies, the school board adopts and monitors an annual budget, updated throughout the year as needed to reflect actual revenues and expenditures. And this is where municipal districts have an additional step, since those districts must get approval from the local government regarding their budget local contribution amount. So, oops, I think I got a little out of order. Go back one. Okay. Sorry. This is what happens when I look at my notes. So on school board elections, an elected school board governs and operates each district, with REAAs being governed by the regional school boards. Specific to REAAs, a regional school board may consist between 5 and 11 members, and that can be proposed for change via petition. An REAA may be, and typically is, divided into sections, with seats assigned per section based on roughly equal number of voters. REAA boundaries and section boundaries are approved in consultation with local communities, the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development, and the Department of Education, with the Division of Elections handling the administration of the elections. Back to the duties. I won't repeat. So when it comes to the funding of REAAs, as noted, the biggest difference in both operating and capital is that municipal districts do have those local contribution raised through tax revenues. Since there's no taxing power in the REAAs, REAA operating funds then are primarily or are entirely within state aid, within the foundation formula, which is that adjusted average daily membership times the base student allocation, and then they will receive federal or other local contributions. Many districts receive impact aid funding, or REAs receive impact aid funding, but there are other federal title grants and other local factors that can contribute. Capital funding is much similar. REAs are primarily 100% reliant on AS 1411 grants for school construction and major maintenance, although there are some federal sources or other third-party sources, impact aid or otherwise, that they can get allocated. You did want to talk about funding a little bit. So for wanted to do a comparison between municipal and REAs. This is taking FY25 data from the foundation for calculations, giving an average funding of municipal districts to REAA school districts. Do note that these does include all the size factors. Many REAAs have a significantly bigger number of smaller schools, which are then increased funding. And district cost factors, the district average cost factor, again, is 0.3 larger than a municipal average cost factor. Additionally, many municipalities do have some correspondence program, and correspondence funding is less per student. So when we take the kind of the district cost factor out of it, but still have the school cost factor and the correspondence, you'll notice the state-funded portion is a little higher in REAAs, but pretty comparable to that with municipal funding once you include the average local contribution that's above the cap, or above the required local, sorry. Facility ownership. Statute does provide for REAAs that ownership of land and buildings resides with the state, and REAAs then are given use permits for the operation and management of the facilities and surrounding premises. It also allows school boards to request title from the state, whether that be leased from a third party or the actual fee simple title that we have. Currently, 8 REAAs have title to all their properties. The remaining REAAs are a mix of either district-owned or leased or state-owned or leased properties. Those use permits are now set out as of 1998 in regulation. It requires that the primary purpose of the property be used for education, that it be maintained in good repair and operating condition. It does note that capital improvements do remain the responsibility of the state. School districts are required to maintain property insurance and other liability coverage. They are to notify the department should there be a hazardous spill or other lawsuits that may result from use of the property. And it does provide that a district may request termination of a property if it's no longer needed for educational use in a community. So capital funding through competitive grants application, as noted, AS 1411 for the School Construction Grant Fund, the Major Maintenance Grant Fund, and the REAA Fund. Regulation provides that, as noted in that use permit, financing for capital improvement projects remain the responsibility of the state. There are other avenues for districts to receive funding, state-funded projects through the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation for teacher housing, both construction and rehabilitation, and then miscellaneous other projects like through Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation for Village Safe Water. There's been a number of lagoon and other water and sewer improvements that have been funded in districts out there. And again, federal grants are also a source of capital funding. Okay, hope that was my 20 minutes.
That you were right on time, Ms. Weed. Are there any questions from committee members? President Stevens.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Could you just comment on that? It appears that, we do have this major maintenance repair grant fund, but it seems like not all the districts that need help are on that list. What could be done to help them to, I know it takes some effort and some assistance to write those grants. Do you have any suggestions on how we can do a better job of that?
Through the chair, President Stevens, Lori Weed for the record. It has definitely been a decades-old question, and even before the state became more fiscally constrained and less applications were received, we think, and from anecdotal conversations with districts. Many districts have minimized their requests due to lack of results on the list. We definitely, the department facilities teams works with school districts to help bolster their applications where we can, you know, saying, you know, this is the areas that you need to improve on, but you're right, it does take time, personnel, and certainly if you want to have a robust capital process, you know, your operating costs kind of have to bolster the needs to do that capital planning. It's part of a facility management program. And that does require cost to do condition surveys and assessments. But I think the commissioner has definitely been more in some of the loop.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us, Commissioner Bishop. If you could please identify yourself for the record. And I believe you have a response to President Stevens' question.
Thank you, Chair Tobin, and to President Stevens. That's a great question. And I would just add to what Lori has shared in that it is identified and it's been well known that that is the process is dispersing money, but we are missing high needs, especially in a time of constraint. And so some of the actions that we are taking are with the bond reimbursement and grant
review,
which is Berger, I guess, the BRGR, I like to say that, where we are adjusting points. And one of those points is the age of the facility, the older it was, the higher points, but that's not necessarily the highest need, really depending on the area of Alaska that you live, the weather could be more. So we're looking at a facility index, a condition index, that is especially for a school that's been in the news before, Sleep Mute. It's one of, it's not as old, but it does have more of the needs than some others. This year or last year, Stebbins, of course, skipped over that due to a fire. But we are trying to adjust. But one of the ideas that we haven't been able to flush out, but that with the legislature we could use some additional assistance, is that initial architecture study or that initial review. If we, those funds within a certain time period are reimbursable once you are provided the funds for the project. What if we could create a fund that especially smaller school districts could get a 0% loan, if you will. They just have to pay it back once they are on the list and funded, and it would just create that fund over and over again, and perhaps it can earn interest at a time and provide those districts that need that additional service and expertise, because it definitely is. It's related as this. You know, there might be a anybody like sports, a basketball team, and you might have your varsity team and your C team playing the same game. They're playing the same game, but you absolutely know that it's not necessarily going to be a great game or a fair game, because although everybody's playing basketball, it definitely was different. And we know that we wouldn't want to put, we wouldn't want to create our schedules around kids that are just learning basketball against varsity kids and just keep having them play all the time. It's not going to be, it's not good for kids, and it's not good for people to watch. So, we would really rethinking it, and the department's leading the way. But, of course, it's all in statute and regulation, so we're working through those processes that government takes time. So I hope that answers your question. There's thought about it out there.
Thank you. It certainly does, Commissioner. I think it's a good idea to think about a fund. You know, I do remember at one time we went down that entire maintenance list and paid it off, got everyone funded, but we've not been able to do that lately, but a fund that would help reimburse sounds like a good idea.
Thank you. Thank you, President Stevens. And just for the record, Commissioner Bishop, could you identify yourself?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, my name is Dina Bishop, Commissioner of Education. I regret you asked me to do that first thing. Sorry.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Ms. Weed.
Thank you, Chair Tobin, Lori Weed. I just, before I left the dais, I did want to note, this is the celebration of 50 years of REAAs as a result of the settlement you'll hear about, I think, in a little bit. There were several facilities, dozens of facilities created across the state. Those are now 50 years old. And while the department now tries to build to a 50 to 75 year standard, those schools that haven't received major renovations are definitely, if they haven't received a major renovation, are definitely past many of their system lives, and those age facilities are at life. So unfortunately, there's going to be a big bump of facilities, but we have 430, 450 schools in this state. And if you figure 75 years of projected life, that's replacing a school, six schools every year, just for statistics.
Thank you, Ms. Wee. That's helpful for us to understand. And I know we will have some remarks from the gentleman who led many of the efforts to build many of those schools. And I believe did a significant number through a geo bond here in the state of Alaska that was able to build those facilities for our students across the state. Are there any other questions from committee members? Seeing none, I want to thank you both again for your very informative presentation. We are now going to be joined by committee aide Mike Mason, who is here to introduce the Senate Concurrent Resolution 17. Mr. Mason.
Good afternoon. My name is Mike Mason. I am staff to Senator Lukey Gill Tobin. So the genesis of Senate Concurrent Resolution 17 is actually a conversation that Senator Tobin and I had with the UAF Chancellor Emeritus Marshall Lind, who served as the Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development from 1971 to 1983 and again from 1986 to 1987. During that conversation, Chancellor Lind noted that this year is the 50th anniversary of the creation of Alaska's regional education attendance areas. And we all agreed that that is a milestone to celebrate. As a result, Senate Concurrent Resolution 17 is before you right now. I would note that Chancellor Lind has joined us today for the hearing. He will be providing some invited testimony in just a moment. I'm sure he can answer any questions that I cannot answer. In your packet, there's a report from the Legislative Research Division that details education funding in Alaska from pre-statehood up until now. That report notes that in the 1970s, it brought changes to the structure of public education through the unorganized borough. In 1970, the state-operated school system was established as an independent agency to provide for public education in that unorganized borough. Prior to that, education was formally administered by the Alaska Department of Education. That state-owned school system was governed by a statewide school board. That system was challenged in court through the class action lawsuit that is commonly known as the Molly Hooch case. That case, which was brought by a group of Alaska Native children, sought to compel the state of Alaska to provide schools in historically Alaska Native communities that did not have schools. That lawsuit was subsequently settled. That settlement document has been included in your packet. As a result of that settlement, the state of Alaska agreed to build and operate public schools in 126 villages. In 1976, as the Molly Hooch case was being resolved, the Alaska legislature, your colleagues, replaced the state-operated school system with the 21 regional education attendance areas that are governed by locally elected school boards and funded through the state foundation formula. Chancellor Lind provided some very fascinating background information on the REAAs that is available on the website of the Association of Alaska School Boards. In that information, Chancellor Lind noted that in the wake of the creation of the REAAs, community interest and pride increased as boards and advisory councils became actively involved in the curricula and the programs reflecting the local culture and values. The new facilities became true community centers, serving as locations for the entire village together, with the gymnasium being especially popular. Over the past 50 years, the REA framework has provided public education in the unorganized borough that is rooted in the simple yet powerful idea that communities should have a voice in how their children are educated. The landmark Molly Hooch litigation affirmed Alaska's constitutional obligation to deliver equitable educational opportunities for children and young adults, regardless of where they live. For five decades, REAAs have educated generations of Alaskans, sustained schools in remote and very roadless communities, and upheld the principle that a child's access to public education should not depend on whether they live in an urban center or a rural village. For 50 years, students and families have relied on REAA schools, which in turn have relied on dedicated staff to keep those schools operating through decades of economic and technological and social change, often under very difficult conditions across immense distances. The resolution that is before you celebrates the 50th anniversary of the creation of the Alaska Regional Educational Attendance Areas and reaffirms the Alaska State Legislature's commitment to strong and vibrant public schools that serve students where they live. On behalf of Senator Tobin, I hope you will support Senate Concurrent Resolution 17. I will actually try to answer any of your questions, but I would note that we have three invited testifiers who know much more about that system than I do. Marshall Lind, who is in the room, served as the commissioner of the Alaska Department of Education from 71 to 83, and then again from 86 to 87. John Hargis is online. He's the superintendent of the Lower Yukon School District. And then Jerry Covey served as the deed commissioner from 1951 to 1995. Thank you for your time, and please support SCR 17.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Mason. Seeing no questions, we'll move on to our first inviter testifier. We are joined here in the room with Mr. Marshall Lind, who served as the commissioner of the Alaska Department of Education from 1971 to 1983, which is the year in which I was born, and then again from 1986 to 1987. Commissioner Lind was also the chancellor of the University of Alaska Fairbanks from 1999 to 2004, which is 1 year before I graduated from the University of Alaska Anchorage and prior to my admittance into the University of Alaska Fairbanks Rural Development Master's Program. Chancellor Lind, when you are ready, if you could please identify yourself and begin your remarks.
Good afternoon. My name is Marshall Lind, and I am honored to be before you today to speak about the REAAs. It's not very often that you get to celebrate something that you were involved in 50 years ago. Either you totally forgot about it or you just don't remember anything about it. This was a significant event in the history of the state. You just had a presentation that was excellent in terms of some of the details regarding the REAAs. The part that maybe I could shed a little bit of light on that might be of interest to you is a little bit of background and why some of these decisions were made. As was indicated earlier, I started as commissioner in 1971. Governor Egan was in office at that time, and Governor Egan, as you know, was heavily involved in the Constitutional Convention, as was the chairman of the State Board of Education at the time, Katie Hurley. She was the chief clerk. During that deliberation of the Constitutional Convention, the emphasis on a system of education open to all was heavily emphasized. Governor Egan heard that, supported that. Katie Hurley heard it many times. And as a result of her leadership as president of the state board, this was a top issue. I don't know if any of you had the opportunity to meet Katie, but she was pretty direct. And if she thought you were full of it, she didn't hesitate to tell you. I heard it many times, believe me. But this was a priority. Then in the early 70s, the settlement of the Alaska land claims was a big issue, as well as the state coming into the oil revenue. So there was a tremendous interest in doing something to have a single system of education. It was mentioned earlier that in the early 60s, there were, 150, 160 BIA schools. I was a part of that. That's how I came to the state, as a BIA teacher. And quite frankly, it was some of the finest experience I've had in 40 years of education in this state. The important part of it was I learned a great deal from the people who live in rural Alaska. I lived in a number of those communities in the Lower Kuskokwim and the Lower Yukon. And I saw what was going on with their educational program. The villages where my wife and I taught had no idea who was coming as a teacher. They didn't know until the plane arrived in the fall or late summer as to who was going to be their teacher. They had very little impact whatsoever in the curriculum. Fortunately, we were able to bring about some change in the 70s with the leadership of both Governor Egan and Governor Hammond and the State Board of Education. I discussed the matter of local control with Governor Egan. He was very interested in that. Governor Hammond came in 1974. He had been involved with the Bristol Bay Borough, supporting the small communities there of Naknek and South Naknek. He believed in the local control issue. We had a number of legislators, people who preceded you, particularly in the Senate, that were very supportive of local control. So we've decided that we needed to initiate an effort to make it happen. Well, how do you do that with the communities spread around over half of the real estate of the state, representing probably 15% of the population, all the way from Annette Island in the south to the northern interior areas, supporting the economic activities of the area, a real challenge, as well as how do you deal with an individual community, such as ADAC at the time, Annette Island and the very south, and communities spread throughout the Aleutian chain. It was a challenge to figure out how to do that. We knew that the only way that we could probably make that happen was to engage some of the Alaska Native leaders to help. We had 1 year to do it from the time the legislature passed the provision for the REAs in 1975, 1 year to make this happen. Well, that was a challenge. Fortunately, people stepped up. They were helpful all over the state to make this happen. It was great. And one of the smarter things that we did was to engage some Alaska Native leaders to lead this effort. And they agreed to do it. Byron Malott was one of them. Roger Lang was the second one. Both of them had been very involved with AFM. That was really a key to make all of this happen. They, in turn, were able to bring in others from around the state, Sidney Huntington, Susan Murphy from Bethel, and others from around Alaska to help put this together. And they did it in a year's time. Well, there were some, of course, that said, how is that going to happen? People in rural Alaska are not accustomed to running multi-million dollar operations. He said, don't worry. They're going to figure it out. And they did. I felt very comfortable that they could do that. I had had the opportunity to work with a number of leaders from the different communities as some time I spent with them in the 2nd Scout Battalion of the Alaska National Guard. Some of these same leaders from the Guard also emerged as leaders in the school district. They handled it extremely well. So anyway, that's a little bit of the background, but it was that optimism in the state at the time that was so exciting. We were coming into money. Local control was an issue, land claim settlement. We had tremendous leadership, the governors, with the legislators. Things were really moving well. It was a fun time to be involved in education. And the issues that you heard today about the shortage of teachers, we had no idea that that would ever be a problem here because people were lined up to get jobs in the state, teaching jobs, administrative jobs. That what we're dealing with today was unheard of. We just couldn't have imagined having that same kind of challenge. So it was an exciting time. The resolution that you have before you, I think, states the issues extremely well in terms of what the REAs have been able to do. Yes, there have been some challenges to certain parts of it. There always are. I don't know when you can come up with a perfect solution to a complicated issue. If you were waiting for that perfect solution, nothing would ever get done, quite frankly. So we did the best we can, we could rather, at the time, and there obviously have had to be some changes. The one really disappointing fact to me, as I look at it, is the negligence that's happened with the capital improvements. When I read about what's going on with some of those schools, thinking, where did we break down with this system? That's absolutely wrong. Totally wrong. The people that live in the rural areas of the state deserve better than that. And it's irritating, quite frankly, as I see it, but I'm not involved in it. I don't work for anybody. Nobody pays me. I'm just an observer now. But I have to say, that's an issue that definitely needs to be corrected. It's not right. Anyway, that's a quick review of the history. Exciting times. And what the REAs brought to rural Alaska was a major change in so many different things, not only in the curriculum and the hiring of people, but it also brought a number of jobs to rural Alaska. Rather than being centralized in some state bureaucracy, those jobs were dispersed to the REAs, and that's the way it should have been, and that has been a real plus. And hopefully in the future we'll be able to bring some resolution to the matter of being able to hire people, teachers and principals and superintendents, but that's not an easy one, and I understand that. But again, as I have mentioned to members of the committee in the past, it starts with being able to get good teachers. And that requires a retirement system that's a hell of a lot better than one we have right now. And you have to be able to pay them. If you can't do those things, we're not going to be able to get them. And generally, the principals come from the teaching staff, and one thing leads to another. And as I read some of the testimony that you heard last week from administrators around the state and the issues that they're dealing with, it's a tough job and very, very different than it was 50 years ago. So anyway, I'd be very happy to respond to any questions that you might have. I might have told you far more than you wanted to know about a little bit of the history, but I thought you probably needed to have that to lay next to the excellent presentation you had from the Department of Education just a few minutes ago.
Thank you.
I'd be happy to answer any question you might have.
Thank you, Chancellor Lind. Are there any questions? President Stevens.
Maybe just comment. You look at the Native corporations today, and we have so many strong Native leaders that have been educated through REAs and through various schools. And I just want to say that without your efforts early on in creating these REAs, it's unlikely we would have had those leaders that we now have. So good on you.
Thank you.
Thank you, President Stevens. Senator Bjorkman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Over the last 10 years, there's been significant tension within the constituency of rural Alaska that's vocal, as well as some of their representatives and legislators here in the building, regarding prioritization of permanent fund dividend and school funding, whether that be for operations or maintenance. With your experience and connected to folks that were around for the constitutional conversations that happened at the birth of our state, as well as constitutional questions that happened around the creation of the fund and then the statutory creation of the dividend itself, what do you think about that tension and balance between the importance of a dividend and the importance of education funding in rural Alaska?
Well, the first dividends came out in 1982, if I'm not mistaken. And prior to that, obviously, there wasn't any tension. And as the years went on, after 82, after that first permanent fund dividend, as the dollars got tight, the tension grew. My personal feeling is the permanent fund idea was a good idea for a few years while we could afford it. Now I think it's time for a change. And I don't believe we can afford both of them with the current system of revenue that we have. We've not done anything in terms of additional taxation, whether it's sales tax or an income tax. We used to have that, as you know. We dismissed that removed it totally. And I know the fiscal situation is tough. I can understand that. But I personally believe at this point in time, we really need to think very seriously about discontinuing that. When you see what's happening to some of our programs, this is what builds our state, the education system. If we fail in maintaining a decent system of elementary and secondary education, you know what's going to happen to the population. You already hear about it. Families are concerned about our schools. And day after day, they read about closing this one, closing that one. Pretty soon they're going to say, well, I don't know about sticking around this place. Now, I know you get into this business of a tax or income tax or a sales tax. Oh, you know, we're going to have to bite the bullet on it and decide, is education indeed a priority? And if so, then figure out how to fund it. If it means we're going to have to reduce it or eliminate the permanent fund, so be it. But if we let this critical piece of our state totally fail because we haven't funded it, we got a real problem, in my view. And I'm not an elected official, so I can say whatever I want to say. So I'm just giving you my straight answer.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Chancellor Lind. We're now going to go on to our next invited testifier. I want to thank you again for joining us and for all the work that you've done in support of education over the years.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We will now hear from the superintendent from Lower Yukon School District, Mr. John Hargis. Mr. Hargis, if you can hear us, if you could please identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony when you are ready.
Yes, can you guys hear me?
We can.
Okay. Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is John Hargis, superintendent of the Lower Yukon School District, and thank you for the opportunity to speak. As we recognize 50 years of the REA system, I want to start by saying this model has been essential to assuring students in Alaska's most remote communities have access to public education. In our district, schools are more than buildings. They are the center of the community, a place of safety, culture, and opportunity. We've seen what's possible when we invest in students. Over the past few years, our graduation rate increased from 65.9% to 77.6%. We've also seen growth in math and literacy and a significant increase in students reporting that they feel safe at school. Those gains are the result of focused investments in instruction, culturally responsive practices, and strong student support systems. I want to be clear that those gains are fragile. REAA districts operate in a very different reality. We receive no local tax revenue. Every dollar comes from the state or federal government, and the cost to deliver education in rural Alaska is significantly higher, whether that's transportation, housing, utilities, or simply getting staff and materials into our communities. We appreciate the recent BSA increase. It made a difference. For us, it generated about $1.5 million and helped reduce our reliance on reserves. But even with that, we are still operating in a deficit. Predictable, sustained increases are critical if we want to maintain progress. I also want to highlight the Kuzlevac Career Academy. This program is giving our students access to hands-on career training and dual credit opportunities that simply wouldn't exist otherwise. For three consecutive years, students who attended had a 0% dropout rate. That's the kind of return on investment we should be building on, but it requires stable residential funding. Finally, access matters. Transportation, broadband, and safe facilities are not extras in rural Alaska. They are foundational to equity. If we want all students to have the same opportunities, those investments have to remain a priority. As we look ahead, the question isn't whether REAA works. It does. The question is whether we will continue to invest in it in a way that allows rural students not just to access education, but to thrive. Thank you for your time and your continued support.
Thank you. Thank you, Superintendent Hargis. Are there any questions? Seeing none, I want to thank you again for joining us here and speaking to the formation and the celebration of the 50th anniversary of the REAAs. We will now move on to former Commissioner Jerry Covey, who is joining us also online. Former Commissioner Covey is a partner at JSC Consulting. Mr. Covey, if you can hear us, if you could please.
Are there any questions?
Mr. Covey,
I want to thank you again for joining us here and speaking.
Mr. Covey, if you could please turn off your television and turn back on your microphone, we can hear your opening remarks.
A partner at JSC Consulting. Mr. Covey, you can hear us. If you could please.
We can hear you, Mr. Covey. You need to turn down your TV.
Mr. Covey, if you could please turn off your television and turn back on your...
We'll take a brief at ease.
Microphone.
And we're back on the record here in Senate Education. It is 4:37 p.m. here on Monday, April 13th. We are joined by former Commissioner Jerry Covey, who is a partner at JSC Consulting. Mr. Covey, if you can hear us, if you could identify yourself and begin your remarks.
Thank you. My name is Jerry Covey. I, as mentioned, I was former Commissioner of Education. My background in Alaska's education system is that I was hired in 1976 when the REAA school districts were first created, and I spent 15 years in Northwest Arctic School District, which initially was a REAA and later became a borough school district. I've worked as a classroom teacher, a principal, a superintendent, commissioner of education, and I've had the opportunity to be an education consultant for 25 years. Thank you for this resolution. I think it's a fantastic resolution, and it speaks to, I think, one of the greatest accomplishments of Alaska, is to establish the REAA school districts. I think this resolution brings to the forefront the fact that the framers of the Constitution were correct when they wrote the state is required to establish and maintain a system of education open to all students. Since 1976, REAA students, mostly Alaska Native, have contributed greatly to our state and local economies, their communities, and their families. You've heard much about the formation of the REAA school districts from the Department of Education and Marshall Lind, and I just wanted to share that, you know, the formation of the REAAs was a multi-year task, and it involved many, many people. Obviously, the legislature was involved, the state board of education was involved, the court system was involved, and all of that involvement was about the what. And the other side of making this happen is the how. And I just want to share that from my perspective, the architect of this whole thing in determining the how was really Marshall Lind. You know, as mentioned, he had been there previous to the REAA as part of the BIA system. He knew firsthand what was happening in terms of education in rural Alaska, what the needs were, and the impact of not having a REAA school district system was for Alaska Native students. And so I think we really have to give him great recognition for making this happen, because he's the guy that made it happen. He's the one that took the what and figured out the how. And the power of local ownership, as Marshall mentioned, I don't think can be overstated. And the impact of local districts has been just phenomenal, and the education is now owned by every community, every school district. And when we think of where we started in 1976, we had a state education system and a BIA system that were ultimately combined into a brand new system. There were a few buildings to put kids in. There was no curriculum. There was no plan figuring out how to move forward. We had to develop all that, and it took a lot of time and effort. And after the creation of the REAA school districts, the Department of Education, led by Marshall, did a tremendous job of working with local school boards to teach them how to do their job and supporting local schools and helping figure out how to move forward with a brand new system. and it was awkward, it was difficult, it was inconvenient, and I know firsthand from looking from that time that it was difficult for us as educators, that it was very difficult for students who had bounced, had been bounced around to different high schools, some in-state, some out-of-state. It was very difficult for them. And, you know, when we look at what was happening then versus what is happening now, even though we have very challenging times, every kid in Alaska gets to get their education in Alaska. And I just think that's a tremendous accomplishment. And it has served our state very well. And I believe if we fund the system and take care of it, it will continue to do so. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Commissioner Covey. Are there any questions? Seeing none, I want to thank all of our invited testifiers today, in addition to to the Department of Education and Early Development for their very informative presentation. I deeply appreciate it. I am going to hold Senate Concurrent Resolution 17 until a future meeting. Please work with my office on any amendments or changes that you would like to consider to the resolution. The final item on our agenda today is the second hearing for Senate Bill 277, sponsored by the Senate Education Committee. We have a committee substitute for Senate Bill 277. The committee substitute has been distributed to members. It is Work Order Draft 34-LS1569/N, as in no attack. Senate Committee Aide Mike Mason is here to explain the changes from version A to version N. We also have my Ted Stevens legislative intern, Jason Ritter, here, who is available to answer questions about the pupil transportation funding section and energy relief payments. Mr. Mason.
Good afternoon. My name is Mike Mason. I am staff to Senator Lukey Gale Tobin, and I serve as the aide for the Senate Education Committee. This is an explanation of changes from version A to version N. So in version A, section 1 of version A was removed from version N. That section sought to adjust the indirect administrative rate for charter school operations and support charged by a school district from 4 to 8%. Once again, that was removed from the version before you now. Section 4 of Version A was also removed from Version N. That section sought to require a cooperative agreement between school districts when a student physically resides in one district but participates in a public correspondence program in another district. Once again, that was removed from Version N. Section 5 of Version A was also removed. That section sought to adjust the factorial included in the school foundation formula for correspondence students from 0.9 to 1.0 of average daily membership. Also, Section 6 of Version A was removed from Version N. That was the section that sought to adjust the base student allocation for inflation in 2025. For inflation that was occurred in 2025. And then Section 7 of Version A was also removed. That was the section that sought to direct a student who wishes to attend a public correspondence program to enroll in their physical school district. So once again, Sections 1, 4, 5, 6, and 7 of Version A were removed from Version N. Version N does include a new section, Sections 1 and 3, to establish a new annual report regarding district-operated correspondence study programs. DEED will include information collected in its annual report to the legislature under AS1407.168. Version N also includes an updated Section 4, which is similar to Section 3 of Version A. However, the pupil transportation funding numbers in Section 4 were updated to reflect the school district's actual expenditures for FY 2024, which is the last full year that we have got the numbers for. And then Version N includes a new Section 16 to establish a one-time energy relief payment to school districts based on a formula derived from a school district's actual 2025 expenditures for heating fuel and electricity divided by the total actual expenditures for all school districts for heating fuel and electricity. The total amount of that one-time energy relief payment will be subject to appropriation. And that is the explanation of changes from Versions A to Version N.
Thank you, Mr. Mason. Are there questions? Seeing no questions, President Stevens.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the committee substitute for Senate Bill 277, Work Order 34-LS1569-N as our working document.
Without objection, Work Order 34-LS1569-N, as in GNOME, is adopted as our working document. Are there any last questions from committee members? I'm going to hold Senate Bill 277 until a future meeting. Again, if you have any changes or considering any amendments, if you could please work with my office, and we will get those drafted and continue to work on this critical piece of legislation. This concludes our agenda for today. The Senate Education Committee will not meet this Wednesday. However, the Task Force on Education Funding will meet Wednesday at 3:30 p.m. in the Davis Committee Room. This meeting is focused on accountability and assessments. I am very excited as task force members will have an opportunity to walk through the AK Star and hopefully take the assessment for themselves.
Madam Chair, I believe that is the goal of the presentation.
I am quite excited about this opportunity to see my colleagues' assessment scores. The Senate Education Committee will not meet on Friday, April 17th. As there is no other business before us today, I will adjourn us at 4:49 p.m.